coming. My name is Daniel Greenberg, and I'm the founder of Earth Deeds. And I'm really excited to talk to you about this alternative to carbon offsetting that we call onsetting, and supporting local solutions to global warming. Right? I'm going to try to make it kind of simple and kind of fun. Okay? What I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about the history, where did this idea come from, which is actually from here. And then I'll talk about what is offsetting, because I realize a lot of people don't quite understand what carbon offsetting is. And then look at this new system called onsetting. And then I'll look at some case studies and what we're actually trying to do with it. So it actually was 5 years ago, almost exactly 5 years ago, when I was in Oroville with my family, my wife Monique and my two daughters, Simone and Pema. And a friend, Marty Mueller, had just come back from Copenhagen for one of the big climate talks. And she was giving a talk. Logistics were such that my then 9-year-old daughter, Simone, had to come with me. And she did not want to come, right? She just heard this talk, it's going to be talking heads, boring, she didn't want to come. So I bribed her, and I said she could use my iPod while I was watching Marty talk. So there we were, and Marty was talking about all of Simone was playing Angry Birds or whatever on my iPod, and Marty was talking about her experiences in Copenhagen, and all the latest research and predictions about climate change, which we all know a lot of, right? From glacial melt, which is predicted to rise sea level at least 3 meters in the next 100 years, perhaps even more. Extreme weather events, which will cause millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, of environmental refugees in the coming years. Species extinctions at a rate we haven't seen in over 60 million years. Extreme drought, like we've been seeing in California and Brazil and in the Caribbean, will become more and more common. And also, she was talking about how this window of opportunity for us to actually do something is dwindling. There's a famous oceanographer called Dr. Sylvia Earle, and she said, what we do, or perhaps more importantly, fail to do in the next 10 years will have a magnified impact on the next 10,000 years. This is the moment. It's not too late. Okay? So we have an opportunity to make a difference, and that opportunity is shrinking. To have at least a chance of keeping our global temperature at 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. She also talked about the dire lack of political leadership, right? To actually make a difference. And about the growing tide of protests and demonstrations, of people saying, we have to act, we can't wait any longer. And so it was an amazing talk, and on our way back, Simone was talking in my ear. And she was saying, my daddy, it's like all those things that lady was saying, with the famine and the drought and the storms and the disease. And she said, is that really going to happen? I get teary every time I think of this. It's like, I don't know how many of you have kids, but it's like, what do you say? It's like, I didn't want to lie to her, but I also didn't want to scare her anymore. So it was a gulp, and I took a deep breath. And what I said was something like, you know, it's true that because of the way that we humans have treated each other and the planet, the coming decades are likely going to be challenging and uncomfortable. But how we respond to this challenge is completely up to us. And if we keep on being greedy and mean, it's just going to get worse. But this crisis is also an opportunity where we, as a species, can actually grow up. And if we can do that, if we can learn how to be kind and respectful to each other and the planet, I believe that this could actually be the beginning of the most amazing time in planetary history. Yeah? And that idea is really the idea that drives everything I do in my life. And it was also the reason why we were in India. So Living Roots, we did programs to eco-villages around the world, and so this was my wife and I, and Ethan, you're in here somewhere, aren't you? There's Ethan. And so we had a group of students, and we were here for 3.5 months in India, and it was a wonderful, wonderful experience to be in Oroville, which we all know and love, and just to be a part of this incredible change that's happened on the planet in this little corner. And it was a real privilege to introduce these students to this amazing vision, and to watch them really transform and to wake up to new possibilities, not only in their own lives, but really for the planet. And so Living Roots was this nonprofit that I started in 1999, and we partnered with the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And what we did is we ran programs, mostly semester programs, some January, some summer programs, in eco-villages around the world. Communities that are trying to live both high quality and low impact lifestyles. Which certainly, Oroville is an eco-village, it's also other things, but it certainly fits that criteria. So in addition to Oroville, we would go to places like Kibbutz Lotan in Israel, Finhorn in northern Scotland, Crystal Waters in Australia, Ecocentury Peck in Brazil, Sachimama in Peru, Monteverde in Costa Rica, Weiwei Kyoto in Mexico, and where I lived for many years, Sirius Community. Notice how it's spelled, S-I-R-I-U-S, not Sirius. And I think in the end there were maybe, well, there were about 1,500 students that went on all of these programs through the years. Weiwei Kyoto in Mexico, where we did courses on leadership for social change. Sachimama in Peru, where we looked at a lot of fair trade coffee, biochar, etc. Ecocentury Peck is a permaculture demonstration community in the Cerrado of Brazil. Crystal Waters, where one of the best permaculture teachers in the world, Max Lindiger, lives, and the community was also built using permaculture principles. And Ecoyov, which is outside of Dakar in Senegal. And this actually helped support a whole movement in Senegal to where today there's actually an eco-village ministry in the high level of government in Senegal. It's very exciting what's happening in Africa in general. So it was wonderful, wonderful work. Unfortunately, Living Roots, I left in 2012 and it ceased operations in 2014. And one of the reasons I'm here is to consider the possibility of reimagining such a program. So I'm very excited about thinking about that. And it was because it was an incredible privilege to do this kind of work. And there was a problem, right? I mean, if you think about it, here's this organization that's all about sustainability, right? I mean, it was in our very DNA, our raison d'etre, why we existed. And yet, what were we doing? We were flying students all over the world, which was emitting megatons of carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, which was contributing to the greenhouse effect and climate change, right? And so that didn't feel good. And so from the beginning, I was trying to figure out how to do this. You know, because we needed to account for our emissions, because fundamentally, we're in this crisis because as a species, we have not... We basically taken nature for granted. We assumed the resources of nature we can use for free. We have not accounted for this. And so we needed to account for these impacts. And let me put it this way. How many of you are familiar with this game show, The Price is Right? You can admit it, I know. It's a Western game show. It's one of these shows where it's very consumeristic. They show you these items and then the contestants have to guess what the price is. And if they're very close, then they might win that prize, right? And if I asked you, how much is this car worth, or a shower stall, or a flight? We have a general sense of what these things cost economically. But if I asked you, how much carbon dioxide do you emit driving around in a car, or a moped, or a motorcycle, or taking a shower, or flying? Most of us don't have a clue. That's a problem. I mean, and it's not like we were born knowing the cost of things and not the ecological cost. No, we grew up in cultures where the economic cost of things is paramount. And that's what we're taught from a very early age. And I believe that if we are to survive, if not thrive as a species, we need to understand that lingua franca of the planet Earth. We need to understand the ecological impacts of our actions. So, to give our students a clue, what I did was I developed a system where the students measured the carbon dioxide of their travel to and from the program. We reduced that footprint as best as we could, which living in places like Oroville and other eco-villages is pretty simple because that's sort of the essence of these communities. And then we priced that carbon. Now I'll talk about pricing carbon more in a few minutes. At that time, there was no good guidance for how to price carbon. So we used the average in what's called the voluntary carbon market. At that time, it was around $15 a metric ton. And we just pulled it out of tuition. So each program had a fund that was meant to, in some way, account for the emissions of that program. Then the question comes, what do you do with that money? Now the easy thing would have been to give it to any one of 100 carbon offsetters. And you're probably familiar with some of them. At least if you're in the West at all. TerraPass is a big one. Native Energy is a big one. And I recognize that this whole idea of carbon offsetting is confusing. The idea is that the activities that we do in our daily lives, whether it's driving or flying or even things that are produced in factories, most of the things we do have an impact and actually produce carbon dioxide. So the idea of carbon offsetting is that you can give a certain amount of money to one of these offsetters, and they will in turn invest a certain amount into a project, whether it's renewable energy or organic farming. So now you can get a certificate that says you're carbon neutral. You are now done. You are sort of at an even keel, right? Now, to their credit, carbon offsetting has raised the consciousness of lots of people to better understand what their emissions are. And they've also put, I think, somewhere between $3 and $4 billion towards some really good projects around the world. So there are some good things about it, but there's also a lot of challenges in the world of carbon offsetting. In order to sell these credits on the voluntary carbon market, you have to bring in verifiers. That costs a lot of money. Some estimate that as little as 30 cents on a dollar actually makes it to the projects. So it's very inefficient. Another problem is that they've often been compared to 16th century indulgences. This is where parishioners in the Catholic Church could actually pay the church money to be absolved of their sins. Right? It's kind of a strange idea. But a lot of people say that offsetting is similar, and that it's allowing people to just buy a clean conscience while delaying meaningful action. Another issue is that the way that the carbon market is priced is based on market forces. The price goes up and down. But that volatility has nothing to do with the actual impacts of those emissions. It was a total economic issue. There's also perverse incentives. So let's say I'm a carbon offset company and you're a project holder. Let's say you're planting trees. I want to buy the right to claim that environmental benefit, that mitigation value of your planting trees. But it's to my advantage to pay you as little as possible to buy that right. Let me, another example. Let's say you pay me some money to plant some trees. But then you find out that, you know what? I was going to plant those trees anyway. And some estimate that as many as 70% of projects would have happened anyway, even without the offset funding. The organizations are usually constricted to working with very large projects because they need an economy of scale. They're saying, if we're going to measure these emissions and we have to hire these verifiers, we only want to hire a couple to do very large projects so that we don't, you know, that more money can come to us. And so also because of that, most of these projects are at a far distance from the consumer. And so there's a lack of meaning. It's like, well, I don't have any relationship to this project that I just supported. carbon offsetting also gives this illusion that, oh, this is easy. All we have to do is all become carbon neutral. And really, I mean, is carbon neutrality the goal? For all these issues, I said, well, I don't want to offset. But there was no alternative. And finally, it occurred to me, what if we just created a whole new system? We could call it onsetting instead of offsetting. And it would look a lot like offsetting. And that we do think it's really important to measure our emissions. We have to understand our emissions. And, of course, we need to reduce those emissions as much and as quickly as we can. And we need to price those emissions because there is an actual cost of the emissions that we put into the atmosphere. So, on that level, it looks like offsetting. Instead of guilty indulgences, we can have a positive story that says, hey, you know what, let's actually be grateful for fossil fuels. They've done amazing things for civilization. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for fossil fuels. So thank you, fossil fuels. And at the same time, let's recognize that there is a cost in using them. So let's reduce as much as we can, and let's recognize this externalized cost, and let's internalize it, and then pay that forward toward projects that we think are actually building resiliency and sustainability in communities that matter to us. And then, rather than base the price of carbon on market forces, we believe that we should price carbon based on the best scientific evidence of what is it actually costing society to put a ton of carbon into the atmosphere. Now, this is a complicated question. And so the best thing that we found is actually called the social cost of carbon, and it's come out of the Obama administration in the U.S. And what Obama did, this was back in 2009 and 2010, he put together an interagency working group. There's about 12 agencies, the Department of Energy, the Environmental Protection Agency, 10 others, and they spent a year with the best scientists available and say, let's figure this out from rising sea level, decreasing agriculture, increased disease rates. And their best estimate today is that a ton of carbon dioxide is about $40 per metric ton. Okay? And this is a figure that will increase over time because the longer we delay action, the more dire the consequences are and the bigger the costs become. Okay. And then, rather than worrying about additionality, about making sure that what we're funding is new and hasn't happened before, let's get the money to projects that we already know and trust are doing good work in the world, right? Small projects, local projects that we have a relationship with. We just started giving that money to projects in the eco-villages that we went to. So, for example, we funded a lot of solar cookers in Senegal. We did a recycling center in Mexico. And one of the things we tried to do was an electric rickshaw in here in Oregon. After about a decade of waiting, I left Living Roots in 2012 to do just that, to set up these tools to really help others acknowledge their impacts and do something meaningful about them. And so I started this organization called EarthDeeds. And I want to be clear, because often this is mistaken. Absolutely, we need to reduce carbon dioxide on this planet as quickly and as effectively as possible. The problem is that there's a much larger cost in the emissions that we're not offsetting, right? And so the idea of onsetting is let's actually account for the emissions that we're doing now, but at the same time, do all these other things that we also want in terms of a sustainable and resilient society. But there's also a lot of other issues that we need to deal with. Biodiversity, as I was saying, land use, fresh water, right? These are important too. We want to get everyone above a social foundation, an equity baseline. And so the first pilot I did, I was teaching sustainable living at the University of Massachusetts a few years ago. And we did this. There was four students that took this on as a service learning project. And they measured the emissions of those students just sitting in those seats learning about sustainability. It was a portion of the university's emissions, and then they looked at their own travel, etc. And they came to the conclusion that it was about 40 metric tons for the class. And so they set a goal based on that. But what they did is they put this out on their social media and asked their friends to help them. And they actually raised more than their target. We're trying to make the sustainable living class carbon conscious. So we don't talk about carbon neutrality, we talk about carbon consciousness, and we erase that line in the sand of neutrality and say, you know what, great, you've done this. And so just to show you how it works, is the students go to this page, we set up a custom calculator for each program. And so the students can put in their flights. So let's say a flight from Miami to San Jose and a bit of ground travel, it totals about 1 metric ton of carbon dioxide. I just figured that out, so you've got a nice even number, right? So 1 metric ton of carbon dioxide is about the same emissions as 292 hours talking on a cell phone, or 100,000 plastic supermarket bags, or what else? It's over 11,000 hours of watching TV.
Is there any prospect at all anywhere in the world?
There already are. There are governments, there are states in the U.S., in British Columbia and Canada, that have been imposing carbon taxes. And I agree with you, that's where we need to go. And then I'd be happy to let the whole thing go because we'll get there. I think it's going to be a number of years before we get there. And what's happening is even in those governments that are imposing a tax, it's at a very low rate. It's like it may be 10 U.S. dollars a ton when it should be at least 40. And so even if they do a tax, we can say, look, there's even a gap in what the government is paying to what we think we should be paying. So, yeah, yes?
When you look at the state of the planet, it's caused by our disconnection from the planet, okay? And let's say reducing our carbon footprint and reducing global warming, and so is, in my opinion, only prolonging the status quo or what we're doing to the planet. And every day we prolong the status quo, we lose on biodiversity. A biodiversity the planet will need after the whole thing collapses.
So what is your suggestion? What is your alternative?
I think we have to think more in terms of what kind of a lifestyle does the planet want,
right,
instead of what kind of lifestyle is that we want to impose on the planet.
I agree with you. I totally agree with you. I mean, that's why we would bring students to places like Oroville, mm-hmm, and Finhorn, because to me, these are the best campuses in the world of people trying to answer that question. Mm-hmm. How can we live a lifestyle that's high quality and low impact? And I think that even the emissions of the students getting here is worth it because it changes their lives. You know, you could say, I mean, I could go radical and say, well, Oroville shouldn't exist, or it should close its doors to visitors because all those visitors are coming and emitting carbon. But we wouldn't do that because it's valuable.
You said you don't believe anymore in the zero carbon emission aims. You don't believe in the aims because you don't think it's possible. You don't think it works out as an aim, even when it's not possible and deadly.
We can't live in this world without emitting some carbon. Yes, absolutely, we should reduce it as much as we can. And that's an edge we can always be pushing. In fact, thinking about farts, there's also the people are doing biological tests with cows, and how do we change, how do we look at their digestive system so that they're producing less carbon dioxide. I don't think we're going to get to zero carbon, and I don't think that's necessary. You know, to get to zero would be such an incredible effort. If we can just get to the place where we're actually just back to pre-industrial levels or lower, that would be fantastic. Wow, all those, that cell phone hours, that uses up a lot of carbon. It's putting a lot of carbon into the atmosphere. So it's helping you make some more informed choices. Like, you wouldn't just go to a restaurant and just buy whatever's on the menu without seeing the price tag, right? And so we're making choices that are emitting carbon without understanding that price tag. This was a whole big idea that I had at the beginning, to have these certifications as sort of a gamification. So you would be certified as carbon conscious, and we actually made labels and stuff, and based on how much you gave, you would get this.
How many plans to connect with governments who are and take this as a tool and offer?
Haven't yet. It's a wonderful idea. We're still just trying to pay our bills. But there's so many possibilities. I mean, think of like Amazon, right? You know, what if every time, let's say you could set up in your profile on Amazon, what's your favorite project? And so that every time you order something, it calculates the emissions of the shipping. You could also look at the embodied energy, but that's a much more complicated thing of the product. Put a tax on your purchase that was going to go to the project that you chose. That would be pretty cool. It tells a story, right? I was talking to someone who does something called the one of these sustainable investment conferences where people come and they offset their conference. And I asked him, why do you do it? And he says, it's for the story. You know, it's because we want to show people that we're doing something.
I personally don't have a cell phone, but I want to know how a cell phone makes CO2.
Someone else could probably tell us better, but it's because of all the infrastructure around the cell phone, the towers, and the making of the cell phones, and the energy that goes into all that. That's where it comes from. But it's interesting, right?
Is there any value or any mileage in identifying companies from whom we could purchase products, services, what have you, which are more conscious?
And there are organizations that are doing that, the Good Buying Guide, or there's even apps that you can look at it, and it'll tell you the whole environmental background of a product. You
know, the reduction of carbon footprints.
The carbon footprints.
Is there any measures to be taken on a small scale?
Yeah. Like, what do you mean? Like, driving a motorbike?
Yeah.
So you can do a small scale on this. Yeah. So we have, what we don't have, which would be a very cool thing we thought about this, is to be able to do some comparisons. Like, what would it be if instead of flying, I drove there? And there are sites that do that. It's complicated. And to say, well, here's some alternatives of things you can do. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate your attention.
Let's forget how fragile we are.